If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
You want the backstory to the interview of the great Molly Hemingway about her brief new book, Rigged, and the column at John Cass News that came out of it? Wait, Jeff Carlin, wait. Don't we need some flashback sound? We did the interview. Molly was fantastic. You'll hear it. I loved her book. I wrote the column, but there was a problem. I had written a draft and then was going to do a full scrub edit on Saturday and then post the column on Sunday. But there was a tiny glitch. The draft was posted almost unedited at my website early Saturday morning. What? I wasn't ready. I checked my phone. People were already retweeting it. And I wasn't ready. Unbeknownst to me, and then beknownst to me, and to my panic, my friend Tom Bevan of Real Clear Politics liked it well enough to link to it on his website. And it went national. And I freaked a little bit, sending urgent texts to the IT guys, all capital letters, WTH, WTH, how did this happen, WTH? And I threw a few pungent WTFs in there too. Then I grabbed two Diet Cokes, jumped into the column, and edited the rest in a rush. You know, I lost 10 years of my life in 1 hour on Saturday morning. Ah, the joys of being free. Free of corporate media, running your own independent small business. Kind of like you're running a banquet hall, warming up your ovens to cook for a wedding of 800 people. The father of the bride has ordered prime rib, and then when you get to the cooler and look inside, all you see are boxes of tofu. WTF. But hey, chill. Bleep happens. It's done. Molly Hemingway, senior editor at The Federalist, is here to talk Joe Biden, the Democrats, election integrity, the delegitimizing of the 2022 midterms, and her book, Rigged. How media, big tech, and the Democrats seized our elections. One thing it offers is a added benefit of me and maybe you imagining the exploding heads of my Jacobin, my lefty Jacobin hate listeners, the heads bursting in neo-Marxist rage. Ah, it pleaseth me. It pleaseth me well. Jeff Carlin, master of sound, executive producer of WGN Radio, and co-host here, is here again, as always. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, chief bottle washer at johncassnews.com. And where are you? Is Joe Biden and the Democrats delegitimize the 2022 midterm elections that are months away by calling everyone who disagrees with them on voter integrity, calling them racist and segregationist because they're afraid of a shellacking? Yeah, that's why, because they're afraid. You're on that street with the broken streetlights. You're on that place where politics ain't beanbag. You're here with me on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Hello.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
And as promised, now we have Molly Hemingway, senior writer at The Federalist, and author of Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. But before we get into talking about that important and brave book, I love to do this because I've got my trolls from the left, and they've been demanding I write a column on, you know, why I think the election was rigged. And one of them, a former editor, keeps harassing me on Twitter. And I just, you know, ignore it because I'm waiting for Molly to come on, and now she's on. But I have to ask you, Molly. Molly wrote probably the best lead of the week, and it has nothing to do with Joe Biden and his banana pudding foreign policy. Here it is, under the headline, "No, Jeffrey Toobin, Biden is not putting Kamala Harris on the Supreme Court." And it begins this way. CNN analyst Jeffrey Toobin took a break from punishing his colleagues by toggling his joystick at work on a Zoom call to opine on who he thinks President Joe Biden might nominate to the Supreme Court. In the event, Associate Justice Stephen Breyer steps down at the end of the term. And Toobin had tweeted, one of his favorites was Kamala Harris for the Supreme Court. I rarely read stuff that makes me outright, you know, laugh to the point where I think my eyes are going to, you know, like a Google doll pop out of my head. But that was one of them. Molly, excellent.
Well, thank you. I truly can't believe that Jeffrey Toobin is employed, and I've been shocked by it for many years because he has so many instances of workplace bad behavior. And I know people who work at CNN, and they can't believe that he still works there after he did what he did, publicly on a Zoom call with colleagues. But apparently he does enough good for CNN's attempt to push the Supreme Court to the left and push the country to the left that they're willing to employ him, even though they will be made fun of for it till the end of time.
and rightfully so, Molly. And I'm with John. That is the best takedown. And the column is spot on. I mean, the fact that even Toobin would say she's a long shot, the Supreme Court is mind-boggling for a bunch of great reasons you laid out. And everyone should go and check out Molly's piece on this because it's fantastic.
Yeah, well, it was outstanding. But underneath it throughout the piece is the definite impression and fact, I think, that the media in this country has gone bonkers, particularly the corporate media, of which I now am not a member. And it's all about force and pressure and pushing the country to the left that it doesn't want to go.
It's nothing but narrative pushing. And you think about how we've had problems with corporate media really for decades. And there are different groups that have been marginalized by the approach the media takes, but Republicans and conservatives have been complaining about it since literally President Eisenhower. But in recent years, it has gotten from just extreme bias, which is very frustrating, to out and out propaganda. And I think what happened in 2015 and 2016, when corporate media openly admitted that they were going to violate their supposed journalistic standards to play an active role in preventing the election of Donald Trump, and they justified this, there was that, you know, front page column in the New York Times about how they had to do this for moral reasons. And when he won, this should have been a huge wake-up call that their credibility was eroding, that nobody was paying attention to them, that they couldn't control the discourse like they had so successfully for so many years. And they should have, if they wanted to have an ability to control conversations effectively in the future, they should have fired all the people who acted poorly, hired and promoted people who weren't crazy, moved away from narrative pushing into just factual reporting, which is something that is important. And they didn't do any of that. They rolled right into the conspiracy theory that the 2016 election was stolen by Donald Trump and Russia. So they didn't really get the story wrong. It was that, you know, Donald Trump was a traitor who had colluded with a hostile enemy to steal our election. And then that set off the next 4 years of hysteria. So,
yeah. And as you note, and you've noted this many times, and so have I, the New York Times and the Washington Post that bit down hook, line, and sinker on the fake Russia collusion story and promoted it have not returned their Pulitzer Prizes, have they? I don't think so.
They haven't, and they won't. And it is appalling that nobody has really been held accountable. And it's not surprising that we have some of the problems we have in this country with people on the right questioning elections when you had an operation to subvert, you know, not just the 2016 election, but to control everything about politics through fake news, propaganda techniques, you know, lies from intelligence agencies. And that's before we even get into how we actually changed all of our election laws to make it less secure.
When we will talk about rigged, and just so you know, Molly's been listeners, Molly's been a guest before on this podcast, and I've written about it when I was at The Paper on Kavanaugh confirmation and Justice on Trial and the hysterics of the left on that one. But this one is rigged. Sounds an awful lot like the left screams about Donald Trump not giving in. He sounds an awful lot like someone who is delegitimizing an election before it happens.
I wanted to clarify, a moment ago, you were asked whether or not you believed that we would have free and fair elections in 2022 if some of these state legislatures reformed their voting protocols. You said that it depends. Do you think that they would in any way be illegitimate?
Oh, yeah, I think it easily could be illegitimate. Imagine if, in fact, Trump has succeeded in convincing Pence to not count the votes. Imagine if...
In regards to 2022, sir, the midterm
2022,
election.
I mean, imagine if those attempts to say that the count was not legit. You have to recount it, and we're not going to count. We're going to discard the following votes. I mean, sure, I'm not saying it's going to be legit. It's the increase in the prospect of being illegitimate is in direct proportion to us not being able to get these reforms passed. But I don't think you're not going to see me, and I don't think you're going to see the Democratic Party give up on coming back at assuming that the attempt fails today.
What does that mean? Molly, can you translate that for us?
Well, I actually don't speak Biden as well as as well as I can translate Trump. That was amazing, though, that at the press conference, he repeatedly says that if they don't federalize these elections and permanently, you know, change all these rules to be in a way that's advantageous to Democrats, that the legitimacy of the elections is in doubt. And what I find interesting about this, it's actually very typical rhetoric for a Democrat politician going back to, you know, the 90s. They tend not to accept election results that don't go in their favor. It's just infuriating and enraging and gaslighting that our corporate media say that when Democrats question the legitimacy of elections, that's totally fine, whether it's Joe Biden or Stacey Abrams or Nancy Pelosi or any of the dozens upon dozens of prominent Democrats who have done so, or Hillary Clinton saying the 2016 election was stolen from her. When Republicans, after the craziest election any of us have ever witnessed, expressed concern about the integrity of the election. Supposedly, that's an assault on democracy, a threat to the republic, and the full force of the law needs to be brought down on every single person who does it. And they go back and forth, and they're treated by such a different standard that it is crazy making for the average observer to wonder, you know, why it's okay when Democrats do it, but why when Republicans, you know, not without reason, are expressing grave concern about the integrity of elections, that that is not allowable and maybe even prosecutable.
It is stunning that media is just a cheerleader for one side to the point where they would break the republic on the rocks of their partisan politics. And I keep looking for people on the left to show some sense. I guess Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald are two of those men of the left who see what's going on and comment on it. But for the most part, you know, people like Yamichi Alcindor and others were just glowing over this news conference and unable to see what Biden had done, or so maybe unwilling.
Let's remember, and even this fact is amazing to me. This is President Biden's second press conference. Is that right? Did I miss one? It's possible I missed one.
No, it was the second one. Yeah.
So he did. He waited until March 25th of his inaugural year to hold his first press conference, and then nearly another year for the second one. It would be more disconcerting if his opportunities in front of the press weren't themselves so disconcerting. I'm not a fan of Joe Biden, but just for like national security reasons,
exactly,
I'm not opposed to him being kept in the basement. And you saw what happened yesterday with his misspeaking on a fraught topic. But at that first press conference, Yamiche Alcindor, who is an award-winning journalist, meaning yes, her peers actually view her as who they want to be like. She asked a question that reminded me of that Chris Farley sketch in Saturday Night Live where he's interviewing Paul McCartney. And he's like, remember when you did that stuff? It was so awesome. Yeah. She says, you know, isn't this crisis at the border we're having really just a function of what an amazing man you are? And then more questions like that. It was horrific. And then yesterday, after this embarrassing press conference with these long pauses and his stumbles and repeatedly saying things that now the White House is trying to backtrack on, she tweets out that it was the best performance she's ever seen of any human being. And I'm like, Yamiche, he's married. You've got to calm yourself. Like, I get that you got a crush on the guy, but this is embarrassing. And she's who our media hold up as their highest standard of a good journalist.
Have you ever been, I had been invited to those obnoxious and horrifying dinners, Gridiron Dinner, the Correspondents' Dinner. And I think it's at the Gridiron where you wear white tie and tails. Mm-hmm. And then you watch colleagues doing skits, like musical skits on the stage to entertain the lords. Have you ever been to that? Or one
I haven't
of those?
Been to the Gridiron, but I've been to some of those. And, you know, even, do you remember we used to have the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner,
yes,
which was a
right,
huge thing where celebrities came, and
right,
Michael Bloomberg would throw this amazing party at the Russian embassy or other places, and it was fun. I personally think Donald Trump destroying the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner might be one of my top five things he did. He truly destroyed it. They couldn't hold the event because I don't even remember why they didn't do it the first year.
Because they hated his guts and they were upset. Yeah, something like that.
They hated him so much that they couldn't have. I mean, it's supposed to be this thing where you gently roast the president and he gently roasts you. And Trump, this great exposer of all the corruption in D.C., just blows it up. And if that never came back, it would be too soon. It was so disgusting to see these media, who are all a bunch of nerds, who think they're so great, think they're so important, just like priding themselves on what great people they are. It was disgusting. And so,
bunch of Tubins.
Yeah, all on display. Although it did, do you remember that it was a White House press correspondence dinner that caused Donald Trump to run for president? So
that's right.
You have to actually appreciate the White House press correspondence dinner, because Barack Obama taunted him as someone who would never become president. And the journalists all cackled and hooted. And you see Donald Trump just being like, okay, let's see about that. And then, you know, 5 years later, he's elected president, and it's just kind of funny.
You know, the odd thing for me is that he wasn't my favorite candidate, though. And I wanted Rand Paul, but the, and I noted that much of media, even CNN and all the cable stations, right and left, basically sucked the oxygen out of the room and gave it to Donald Trump. And so I wasn't a fan of Trump, but you know, I liked the policies. I did not like the personal behavior. But the what drives me to the right is the left, because they give me no place to stand. It's it's like they give average Americans. I'm a Midwesterner in the flyover country. Jeff is too. They don't give us a place to stand. And I wonder, did you come to that similar?
I had a bit of a more circuitous route, which is that when Trump first came on the scene, he was saying things about the Republican Party that I loved, because I did not like the Republican Party very much. And so I kind of cheered that on. And then when it seemed like he was going to win the nomination for the Republican Party, I absolutely freaked out and thought, there is no way that this can happen. This is very bad. And so I have this, you know,
me too,
initially kind of favorable response, then an extremely negative response. I was sure he would be a New York liberal, pro-abortion, like fiscally profligate guy. And the fiscally profligate thing might have turned out to be true. But once he won that nomination, and how he won the nomination, I end up, you know, just personally, I end up voting for him. But I just expected him to be not as bad as Hillary Clinton. And I remember that it was this third debate, I think it was, with Chris Wallace, where he asks Donald Trump if he'll accept the election results if he loses, and he declines to say yes, or, you know, I can't remember exactly how he said it. And the media just flipped out over that.
Chris Wallace, too. He was clutching his pearls.
He didn't ask Hillary, even though she was the one who would end up causing so much trouble by not accepting the election results for 4 years. But also, Hillary Clinton said she was willing to accept a proxy war with Russia over Syria. And for me, that just made me realize, like, okay, we can't do more of this neocon type foreign policy. We just can't do. So I sort of happily voted for him. Not happily. I reluctantly and didn't tell anyone, you know, but but I just expected him to not be so bad. But I had no expectation he would actually govern like a conservative, that he would actually do the things he said he would do. And so within a year, I was thrilled.
The which brings us to your book, Rigged: How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. Tell us, I mean, I've read it, and I'm reading it again, ordered it on Amazon. You can all get it if you want, and I think you should get it, because there's so much sound of barking dogs and empty-headed jays around this topic that you should have something to hold on to, and Rigged is one of them. But Molly, how was the election rigged? Because I don't think it was stolen.
I'll just say
I've said at the paper that I'm now happily gone from, and later on my own site, I've said it wasn't stolen, but I thought it was rigged. And this created, you know, the hair of the Jacobin. They pulled their hair out in rage when I said that. But tell me, how do you assess it? You wrote the book. How was it rigged?
So first off, I just want to say that I knew I had to research it because I was extremely frustrated with how people were talking about it after November. It was weird to me, you know, that you had these like twin conspiracy theories popping up from the extremes. You had people on the right saying, you know, Venezuela and voter systems, and it just seemed very extreme. And then you had people on the left say, contrary to what we all knew, actually, this is the most, you know, fair election we've ever had. There were no problems, and you weren't allowed to talk about it. And I thought that was creepy and indicative of major issues in play. But when I started writing it, I knew I wanted it to be called Rigged. I'd actually talked about the rigging of the election prior to the election day. And for me, a lot of that had to do with how establishment forces had rigged the game in non-technical ways, meaning the media corruption, blatantly suppressing easily the most important story of the campaign, which is the Biden family business and the corruption of the Biden family business, how tech companies alter algorithms to elevate lefties, to deplatform effective conservative voices, how the media had created fake news for years to paint an image of a presidency completely at odds with what it actually was. You know, that's what I was focused on.
Yeah.
But I knew I had to look into some of these claims that were out there too. And it turned out rigging was exactly the right word to use, because the Democratic Party has invested quite a bit in controlling election procedures. It's something the Republican Party should have done more on earlier. And they had a coordinated effort run by the exact same guy who ran the Russia collusion hoax, Mark Elias, to change the laws and procedures in hundreds of instances across the country. And sometimes those were done legally. And legally, I mean, they went to the legislature. They got the legislature to make the changes. That's what our Constitution says you are to do. More often than not, it was done outside that means. They would go to a very friendly Secretary of State and sue them and say, you know, you can get out of this by just agreeing to our list of demands, which of course they would. And it wouldn't go through the legislature, even though it dramatically altered the integrity of the election. This was done in an effort to help something very particular to Democrats, which is mail-in balloting, which was the Democrats' campaign strategy for 2020. And this is a good one for them to have, because Republicans are leery of mail-in balloting for a variety of reasons. They understand it's less secure. That's something we all used to acknowledge prior to 2020.
And even Democrats, even Carter, President Jimmy Carter, as you note in your book, warned about mail-in balloting as a corrupt practice.
Yeah, Jimmy Carter, The Washington Post, New York Times, everybody acknowledged this, and it's obvious. I mean, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out that when you have as many moving parts as are involved with mail-in balloting with next to no scrutiny, you are ripe for problems. Doesn't mean you will have problems, but you're ripe for problems. And you really have to think through, if you're going to do it, and I'm not a big fan of doing it, but if you're going to do it, you have to put systems into place over the course of years to make sure that the integrity of the ballot is not more in question than it needs to be. And none of that was done because this was all rushed through with COVID. And it was just a free-for-all chaotic mess of tens of millions of mail-in ballots. Sometimes they were, you know, bulk mailed out to every address on the book, even though 10% of the country moves each year. So you have a lot of people on voter rolls who no longer live in their residence, and that also increases opportunities for fraud and problems. But it makes it hard to catch it too. And then the other thing that I could not believe when I discovered was that one of the world's wealthiest and most powerful men, Mark Zuckerberg, financed the coordinated takeover of local government election offices by left-wing activists. And we should talk about that at length.
Yes. How did he do it?
Okay. So it's a little complicated, but it's important that people understand this. So he gave $419 million supposedly for COVID relief. And any county could apply for these funds to help with their elections as it related to COVID. In the end, only 1% of the funding went for COVID issues. What actually happened was the money went to do everything from let's first explain this. The money predominantly went to blue counties in swing states. anybody could apply, Republican counties, Democrat counties, and a Republican county might get $5,000. And then the Democrat county of Philadelphia, the city of Philadelphia, gets literally $10 million. So when people complain about this, they say, well, we financed both Republican and Democrat areas. That's true. But it's not true that it was even on a per capita basis. And even more than that, they focused their efforts on blue counties in swing states. And I think people kind of wonder about the election. How was it that Biden won and Democrats took the Senate, but that Republicans gained seats in the House and nearly took the House? It just doesn't make a lot of sense. This explains that weirdness, because by focusing on blue counties in swing states, they were able to control the state outcome, but they, of course, didn't waste their money on local seats, or like their funding in these blue counties and swing states wouldn't affect the House because those areas are already electing Democrat representatives. So by focusing on Democrat areas of swing states, the funding would go to registering voters in those Democrat areas of swing states, communicating with voters about how to vote, printing up ballots, designing ballots, translating ballots, curing ballots, which is where you fix the ballots of Democrat voters in swing states, but you don't do it in the Republican areas. Counting ballots. Basically, every part of the process had a role for these liberal activists that were shipped into the system by this Zuckerberg funding. It was a brilliant strategy, completely unfair, completely unethical. And that's why you're seeing so many states pass laws to ban the private takeover of government election offices. But it was just an unbelievable effort, and it made all the difference. There have been studies shown that it made the difference in Wisconsin, that without this Zuckerberg funding, Trump would have won Wisconsin by tens of thousands of votes instead of losing by 20,000. And the analysis continues in other swing states, and I'm assuming you will find the similar outcome, meaning this Zuckerberg funding determined a lot about our election.
And it's so terrifying that this playbook was so essentially easy to institute. And it's not just a playbook that we are, you know, we see in politics. Obviously, it's been a hot button issue, but these types of things, and we don't even see it in the media. We don't see it in social media. People don't even realize that they're being taken advantage of, and they're in on it. They think, oh, this is great. This is all good. You know, these people are do-gooders, and they're going to fix the system and make it easier and make sure my vote is counted. But it's just become so much a part of non-questioning, right? You don't question these things anymore. And so you wind up in this kind of, and you know, the Matrix just came out, right? People don't realize they're in the Matrix of all of this, I feel. And Molly, your reporting is fantastic because it really pulls back the curtain. And it's not just these elections. It could be something that could be used in any form of our lives that can influence and impact people, from what we eat to what we buy. And it's happening every second of every day. And it's just, people need to read your book. That's very important.
But the difference here, I think, is that when you have the country insecure about the integrity of elections, and then you have the media producing and fomenting lies and covering for racism, like Joe Biden, you know, comparing all of those of us. We stood in line for the COVID IDs, but we can't use a voter ID. I got coughed on by two elderly people for like half an hour in line, but I don't get a COVID ID. I mean, we don't have a voter ID. All of this conspires to where we are now, which is, I think, a dangerous moment, because I'm not hearing Republicans talk about and conservatives talk about, let's debate the left on its own ground. Now I'm hearing basically, let's take out the rhetorical tomahawks and begin chopping away, because debate doesn't exist when you have media so corrupted. What do you think,
Molly?
Well, I have some level of happiness in seeing people question the assumptions built into questions from corrupt media figures, but I'm kind of shocked that it's not happening much more. And if you're a non-leftist person interacting with the media and you don't immediately and almost reflexively question the assumptions they have built into their into every single one of their questions, yes, you're not doing things right. And you do not deserve to be in a leadership position. And yet we see a lot of senators and other people just acting like it's 1987 and that they can take these people as if they're acting in good faith. And that was stupid in 1987. It's inexcusable now. And it's also just stupid for them if they want to keep their hold on power. I think one of the things you've seen in the Republican Party is this, the people seem to want policies that help them economically, culturally. They're looking for a party apparatus that serves their needs and saves the country. And then you have the establishment that just sort of seems to want to bring everything back to the Bush era. They really liked that. They thought things were going very well with their wars and with their bailouts of Wall Street and with their open borders policies. And they just kind of want to get back there. That was very nice for them.
Yeah.
Well, if they want to have power, they have to understand that Republican voters need, I mean, you have to like try a little bit to trick Republican voters, and they're not even trying. They're just reminding Republican voters of everything they hate about the Republican Party. And if they truly want to keep Trump from running again or someone like him, they should show some backbone and spine and ability to fight the media instead of just bowing down and trying to be treated nicely by them.
They don't realize the monster they created or the void they created. I mean, and it's the killer, the kicker in my in our world in Chicago is that we've got a mayor who when she gets questioned about from the like the left media, who's even left of her about things, she gets angry at them. And, you know, it's like these are the people that created what the void that allowed you to take power. And now you're upset because they're asking you questions about things that you've promised. Come on. It's just it's so funny to watch people get devoured by the own machine that they created.
It is. Or you think about like the Democrat Party in general, which has this fringy base that has now dominating the entire party. In the press conference, it was Peter Ducey actually asked, why are you taking the country so far to the left? Which is not a bad question. But Biden responded that he was in the mainstream of the Democrat Party. And I thought that's actually true. Like not a single Democrat in the House has opposed his agenda, and barely anybody in the Senate has. You've got like two senators who find him too liberal, but that's pretty good percentage for him in terms of 99% of the Democrat Party is behind Biden's crazy policies. The country doesn't seem to like it in general, but his party is pretty unified. So the base of that Democrat Party kind of ate itself and is making it toxic to the rest of the country.
Back on Rigged, I need to ask. I agree with what you put out there and discussed in your books and in your articles in The Federalist. And one note, you remind me of my former editor, and I love her, Kristen McQuarrie, because if you read Molly Hemingway in The Federalist, she's a freak on links. you're a link freak, but that buttresses your arguments because you're letting people see where you're coming from, who you're referring to. But here's my question: if true, but where were the Republicans while Zuckerberg and all this stuff was going on? Were they actively, or were they just doing some sort of, you know, French Revolution, you know, middle class? Oh, I don't know what happened. What happened? I don't know. It wasn't my job to keep your head.
Okay, there clearly were failures, but people overstate the failures a bit. And I just want to say, one of the things I found so shocking, I interviewed Ronna McDaniel, and she told me about something which it's not been hidden. It's actually been reported before, but I was shocked by it, which is that the Republican National Committee was barred from having a role in Election Day oversight. And now Election Day means election season, election year. They couldn't get involved in litigation or any oversight activities of Election Day for nearly 40 years because they had been put under a consent decree in the early 80s by a New Jersey federal judge who slapped them with this punishment that they couldn't have any role in it because of how they handled a gubernatorial election in the early 80s. And he kept them under that consent decree for nearly 40 years. He retired from the bench, but took senior status just so he could keep them under the consent decree. And it was so sensitive that in 2016, Sean Spicer was on the wrong floor of Trump Tower on election night, according to this consent decree, and they nearly extended it again. And it took this judge dying and getting replaced by another liberal judge, but like a sane liberal judge, to get them out of this consent decree. So 2020 was the first presidential election in nearly 40 years that they could play a role in. And to their credit, they hit the ground rolling, but they didn't have a lot of experience in how to fight Election Day stuff. And they did effectively battle this Mark Elias character in many states prior to the election. And they didn't do enough. And I actually write a little bit about this, that the Trump team is annoyed that they're not doing more. So they take over election stuff really in June of 2020, which is about a year and a half too late to get started. So both the Trump campaign and the RNC had failures, but they both also had some pretty big wins. And they actually worked together pretty well in accomplishing those wins. As for the Zuckerberg thing, truly nobody had any idea at how savvy this operation was. They encouraged Republican counties to apply for the funds. They didn't know that, you know, that the $5,000 they were getting was just chump change compared to the million, tens of millions that other people were getting. They didn't really figure out the operation until months after it was concluded. So that one, they dropped the ball on, but they just didn't know. And it was so brazen. I don't think they had the imaginative capacity to figure out what a brazen rigging of things was going on.
And it's not one of those things that's apparent, you know. It's not like there are flyers always going around in paper or see people seeing them, because a lot of stuff was so digital. But I think my read on that was the ultimate irony there was that I think in 2016, one of the reasons that Democrats unexpectedly lost in their minds was that the Trump campaign was so good at using, you know, micro algorithms and targeting on social media, specifically Facebook. And the Democrats almost learned that they got caught not knowing that stuff. And then obviously Facebook realized what they were involved in and use it against the Republicans, which to me is kind of an irony. But it goes to this other idea that I talk about with the friends of mine. And I wanted to get your take on this, Molly, that this technology, you know, when even in media, when we started looking at like cable and its development, and now we're in the internet era where we have social media and the internet, we don't realize how much power is out there to be used in nefarious ways against us, because this stuff is just uncharted and nobody really, I think, grasps that, especially in the government. I mean, our average age of Congress people is what, in the 60s? And they're completely out of touch with the technology. And I wanted to get your take on that and see what you think about, you know, if that naivete or even that world needs to be controlled somehow, or at least put guardrails up. I mean, it just feels like we're going to keep running into this situation.
I mean, that's way too little. Much, much, much more needs to be done. But you're absolutely right, Jeff. Like, after the 2016 election, you have a bunch of big tech oligarch type people openly admitting that they feel guilty, that by allowing Donald Trump to work through them to reach voters, they're responsible for this horrible event of him winning the presidency. The media had lied about him, and so Trump just uses social media to speak directly to the people. They find his message compelling, they elect him. And so these big tech people said, we can never let this happen again. And so they set about rigging everything. And you said it was ironic, and I love like remembering the 2016 conspiracy theory that Donald Trump stole the election was ultimately based on this like crazy idea that because Russians had bought $100,000 in Facebook ads, some of which benefited Hillary, some of which benefited Trump, that therefore, thereby the election had been stolen. Well, if $100,000 in muddled Facebook messaging is enough to steal an election, what do you say about all of the algorithmic manipulation worth probably billions of dollars done by these tech companies, and yet we're not doing anything about it? I mean, if you really care about free and fair elections, part of that is that you can't have a propaganda press. Part of that is that you have to have a free flow of information. And so, of course, these people in Congress should care more, and they're completely... they're mostly clueless. I do think
they want the
voters
money.
Are demanding enough that you'll see more once Republicans take the House.
But don't they want the money? In some ways, these Republicans, and again, I'm a conservative, not a Republican, but they remind me of Lindsey Graham talking about, boots on the ground in Syria while he's getting more, defense money contracts from the guys in the woodies in Virginia in the horse country. It's like that to me.
It's like they have this short-term benefit of getting huge checks from Facebook that can help them in a primary, and they don't think about how they are accepting the money that will lead to the demise not just of their party but of the country. And so you need people who are willing to stand up against it, even though it's very hard when so much money comes from these people.
We've talked a long time, but I have to ask you as we close, what do you read? What does Molly Hemingway read? What do you watch? What's your media? What films do you like besides the great McGinty, which I recommend to all?
I don't watch TV news, but I love watching TV. And my husband and I are kind of homebodies who just enjoy spending time together. And occasionally we do like to unwind, at the end of the day by watching something. We just watched, and I'm not sure if your listeners will be into something like this, but I loved it. It's an HBO series called Hacks, with Jean Smart playing the part of a stand-up comic with a long run and a Vegas show. The morals are awful. The politics are annoying, but just in terms of her acting and how much she holds this show together, it's to me, it's worth seeing. So I really enjoyed that.
It's a lot. I think it's more attractive to me than when Betty has is doing her "This Is Us" night. I have to hide in the basement with the dog because I can't take the crying. The whole country is crying. I'm just sick of the crying of the country. I'm sick of it.
I haven't seen that, but I hear everybody call it the crying show. So I don't think I'll be checking that out.
Yes, it's the crying show. But the crying show this week will be watching the Sunday Talkers, because they're going to try to tell us that Joe Biden had a great press conference when in fact he did not. And then the Russian and Ukrainian reaction to it all. Molly Hemingway, thanks again for being here on the Chicago Way. And if you ever come to Chicago, you and Mark could be our guests at some obnoxious Chicago steakhouse where politicians stare at each other over gin martinis, okay?
I would love to do that, so might hit you up on that.
All right.
Thanks, Molly.
Thank you.
Thanks, Molly. That's Molly Hemingway, author at The Federalist, writer, and the author of Rigged: How Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. Order it and read it, because if you're going to move the earth, as Archimedes said, you need a place to stand. So get it. Thanks, Molly.
Thank you so much. That was really fun.
For Molly Hemingway, senior writer at The Federalist, author of Rigged: How the Media, Big Tech, and Democrats seized our elections. Then for Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, my friend, master baker of pies, lover of cats, unfortunately. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist at johncassnews.com. Thanks for joining us again on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.